CJSF 90.1 FM, Burnaby, BC, striving to provide points of view that are rarely expressed in mainstream media.
Canadian Philosophy Show. We were really intimidated by the last show we did, which was supposed to be an introduction to the history of Western philosophy. Little did I know that that topic is basically it's not looking for a needle in a haystack, it's looking for the hay in a stack of needles. There is a lot of complexity and a lot of nuance in the discussion of what exactly is the history of Western philosophy and how the ideas of many philosophers are related to each other. So today we're going to do something a little bit less ambitious and just talk about Plato and Aristotle and their influence on some major philosophers, although we might not even get to that last part. So in our last episode, we articulated and discussed a little bit of Plato's theories of forms. And this is one of the most fundamental differences between Plato and Aristotle. So I'll read this out from an article that I found on Encyclopedia Britannica. So this is the most fundamental difference between Plato and Aristotle concerns their theory of forms. For Plato, the forms are perfect exemplars or ideal types of the properties and kinds that are found in the world, corresponding to each such property or kind is a form that is a perfect exemplar or ideal type. Thus, the properties of beautiful and black correspond to the forms of the beautiful and the black. The things horse and triangle correspond to the forms the horse and the triangle, and so on. A thing has properties it has or belongs to the kind it belongs to because it participates in the forms that correspond to those properties or kinds. A thing that is a beautiful black horse, because it participates in the beautiful, the black, and the horse. A thing that is a large red triangle, because it participates in the large, the red, and the triangle. A person is courageous and generous because he or she participates in the forms of courage and generosity, and so on. For Plato, forms are abstract objects, existing completely outside space and time. Thus, they are knowable only through the mind, not through sense experience. Moreover, because they are changeless, the forms possess a higher degree of reality than do things in the world, which are changeable and always coming into or going out of existence. The task of philosophy for Plato is to discover through reason, or the dialectic, the nature of the forms, the only true reality, and their interrelations, culminating in an understanding of the most fundamental form, the good or the one. Aristotle rejected Plato's theory of forms, but not the notion of form itself. For Aristotle, forms do not exist independently of things. Every form is the form of something. A substantial form is a kind that is attributed to a thing, without which that thing would be a different kind or would cease to exist altogether. Black Beauty is a horse attributes a substantial form, horse, to a certain thing, the animal Black Beauty, and without that form, Black Beauty would not exist. Unlike substantial forms, accidental forms may be lost or gained by a thing without changing its essential nature. Black Beauty is black attributes an accidental form, blackness, to a certain animal, who could change color. Someone might paint him without ceasing to be himself. Substantial and accidental forms are not created, but neither are they eternal. They are introduced into a thing when it is made, or they may be acquired later, as in the case of some accidental forms. So I wanted to add briefly that Aristotle is seen as the forefather or predecessor to the ideas of empiricism. that everything we know through sense perception, and of course, empiricism and that type of only knowing about things through sense perception is part of the reasons behind modern science. So Aristotle is seen as the grandfather's grandfather, grandfather to the Enlightenment and the scientific thinking that is very popular today.
It's weird because you're not wrong at all. Something like an empiricism is what comes in to sweep away the scholastic disputatiousness of the medieval period. But Aristotle is that stuff that is also getting swept away. So Aristotle's empirical bent, you're absolutely right. Aristotle of the, between Plato and Aristotle, Aristotle is the empiricist. He's the one who says if you want to know what things are, you actually have to go and look in the world. And that is also the attitude that, or that it will be part of the attitude that forms the Enlightenment, that we have access to knowledge. It's not a sort of, it's not locked behind anything, really. We can go out there and investigate, and it's perpetuated by all kinds of things happening in the scientific revolution. It's a historical period. But it is worth mentioning that Aristotle is one of the things which, or one of the thinkers who will be superseded in the Enlightenment. I'm being tense here because you're absolutely right. The impetus which moves Aristotle to do what he does is a contributing factor to the Enlightenment, and yet Aristotle will be superseded. Maybe it's a kind of...
Do you want to speak a little bit to that? Like, how is Aristotle superseded in the Enlightenment? What were some of the problems uncovered in his ideas?
Yeah, so, I mean, basically it has to do with this... when I go and I read particularly Descartes, Bacon, and Hume, I find that they accuse Aristotle of a disputatiousness, that Aristotle discovers things by checking the doxa, the endoxa, the good and true opinions of what people really seem to think, comparing the opinions out and seeing which opinion holds out, and he tries to supply his own ideas about what goes on. Now, when at the time that Bacon is writing, Francis Bacon, the English philosopher, who is kind of the impetus to the scientific empiricism, he says that we need a new method, we need a scientific method, which is kind of where Aristotle comes in. And yet, again, Aristotle will be superseded because he says Aristotle just he kind of just battles opinions. He doesn't actually have an experimental method. He says go look at the world, and yet he really doesn't seem to do that. I mean, he is, because he has these incredible biological treatises where he has examined animals, but it's not in an experimental form. So he's not. And specifically, this is leveled against his physics. His physics is he's a kind of armchair physicist in that way. It's brilliant to read, but if you want to move ahead, Bacon is saying you need a new method, and Aristotle just is not going to cut it.
Well, obviously, there's like some distinct differences between Plato and Aristotle, and I'm certainly not a scholar in either. At the end of the day, they're both coming from a world, a tradition, a perspective that is very concerned with, I guess, what you might call first principles, that kind of like classic philosophical knowledge. And as I think Brandon kind of so simply but eloquently put it, like, when you go about examining the world that way, you experimentation in the more modern scientific sense isn't really important. You can effectively sit in your armchair or in the forum or wherever you are and say, well, we've got certain principles about change or being or life or whatever it might be. And so we can deduce from these first principles all sorts of details and aspects of whether it be, like Brandon said, physics, animals, human psyche. But I remember reading, I think it might have actually been in a work by Neil Postman, but we're basically an author once said of Aristotle that the idea of going out and actually experimenting and testing theories was just not something that Aristotle ever really like thought about. I know that's pretty broad, but it just wasn't really in like the, you might call it the examinational repertoire of people in that world, right? Oh, the world is this way. We know it's this way because we have like these certain obvious principles. They're self-evident and true. You don't need to go out and like look at 1,000 different beetles to figure out like details about that being, right? That's just not something that they were super interested or I guess were pushed in the kind of direction of doing by the way that they viewed and saw it existed in the world.
Yeah, those are both really interesting comments. It's bizarre for us in the modern day to think of a world where science doesn't exist. To like to think that like it's like, well, if you want to know how something works, well, you just use the scientific method. You make a hypothesis, you run a few experiments, you see what happens, and then you make a new hypothesis or your hypothesis is confirmed and you make more experiments. It's ubiquitous to us. It's something that it has always existed to us, and it is just ridiculous to think that it never existed. In times in history in the past, it really didn't exist. For Aristotle, when he was thinking about what type of knowledge could exist, he was limited by, you know, the fact that only really Aristotle was limited by basically just Plato and Socrates. Those, his teacher and his teacher's teacher, that was basically all he had to go on. And of course he had the written records that his teachers had access to, but in that day and age, how many written records did they have access to? It's probably something that we could debate a little bit, but definitely not the internet and definitely not tens of thousands of books and the works of hundreds of thousands of scholars like we have today. At the same time, we're dealing with fundamental problems of questions about the nature of philosophy, the nature of knowledge. And it's very interesting to think about, and perhaps it's a little bit even addictive to think about, what is the nature of knowledge? Is it an abstract object, as Plato was thinking, or is it within the objects that currently exist? So does knowledge come into being when something exists, or does knowledge exist outside of the things that exist, and then when something is brought into existence, it's just a shadow of the forms?
It's a good question, and it brings us back to what you introduced us to, which is this difference between Plato and Aristotle's metaphysics, specifically their metaphysics of form. Essentially, if you want to ask the question, okay, what is that? I'm pointing at something. What is that? Both of them agree that if you want to know what it is, you have to inquire into its form. Now, what they think form is differs, and alluding to the empiricist bent in a kind of negative way with Plato, he says, if you want to know what something is, you don't even really have to look at the world. You just have to figure out what its form is. If you want to know, again, using Black Beauty as an example, well, Black Beauty's a horse. You just have to discern the form of the horse. But the form of the horse isn't itself in this world. What there is to know is not in this world. Aristotle categorically rejected that by taking the form, or by taking forms and giving things their form back, basically. He says that if you want to know what something is, you will see that if you look at it, its form is there. Now, interestingly, Aristotle doesn't think that things just are their forms. He has a complicated relation between their form and their matter. So he says it's not really true to say that for Aristotle, if you want to know what something is, you have to look at its form, because for Aristotle, things are more than just their form. Form takes a certain priority over all the other parts of something, but form and matter are really, really important for Aristotle. So if you want to know, let's say, what a book is, sure, you have to look at its form, but you have to ask also, okay, well, what is it composed of? It's composed of, well, a hardback will be composed of board, paper, ink, and then the form will be, well, you have the hardcover surrounding the pages, which are in order, and then the words are formed in a certain way. You can explain what a book is through that. Interestingly, what that also means for Aristotle is that everything that can be known, because it exists in the world, it has something that Plato's forms don't have, and that is that they have duration. They exist in time. And that means that they are caused. For anything that exists in the world, it is there. And if it's there, it's there for a reason. It gets caused. So if you want to inquire into what something is, you will also learn a lot about what it is if you figure out what its causes are. And Aristotle has four causes for things. They're kind of famous, but they are the... We've already talked about the material, the material and the formal cause. We'll get more into them because there's more to say about the formal cause. But essentially, when something is generated, you can ask, what is its material cause, its efficient cause, its final cause, and its formal cause. Now, the other two are the efficient and final cause. The efficient cause is what causes... No, it is basically the agent of the cause. So if you have anything that comes into being is caused to be by another being. So a bookbinder or a machine, depending on how the book is made, assembles the book. There has to be something to create that thing. For Aristotle, there's also the final cause, which explains I don't want to say like a misunderstood, because I think it's well understood in the scholarship, but it's an often initially misunderstood cause, that the final cause is the kind of purpose or the end to which something is created. So say a book is a conveyor of information, so you use it to convey information. If we didn't need to convey information, there would be no cause of the book, right? That's one way of understanding it, but another way of understanding it is also that something kind of has an end. It achieves a certain purpose at the point at which it's finished being caused, and that is a book is sufficiently good at conveying information, and that causes it. The interesting thing, though, is that among all these, Aristotle does think that the formal cause, and this is probably the Platonic inheritance, the formal cause has, a certain priority. And I remember when I studied Aristotle's four causes, I came up with a kind of way of figuring it out for myself. So I'll try and run it by you guys, and hopefully you guys intuit what I'm getting, because I've wanted to try this out a little bit too. So the typical example of an Aristotelian generated object is a house, right? So we'll just use a house. Let's go through the four causes: the material, the efficient, the final, and the formal. Now, what would happen if we were to lack one of these causes? Say, let's just take out the material cause, you know, a house is made out of bricks and stuff. So we've got the final cause, we want to house a family. We've got the efficient cause, we've got the builders, and we have the formal cause. We've got the form of a house in, you know, we understand how to build a house, but we don't have the materials, right? So we can't proceed with actually causing the house to exist, right? Now let's do this with the efficient cause. We've got the bricks laying around, we've got the family, and we've got the form, but there's no builders. We can't make it, right? Again, you can see this, how this works with the final cause. You don't have a family, well, you don't have any reason to make the house. But there's something interesting that I found when you take out the formal cause. You have the house, or you have the bricks, you've got the family, you've got the contractors. There isn't anything actually obstructing you now from assembling the house. Now it's just actually a matter of putting it together. If you lack any of the other causes, you are actually obstructed from being able to put it together. But the formal cause kind of completes the whole process. And I think it's in that way that Aristotle saw a certain priority to it, that its form sort of initiates or is the possibility for its being caused. Is that making any intuitive sense, or?
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of intuitive sense to me. So to go along with the idea of the formal cause, because I think that's a great thing to talk about here, it's really interesting to think that, like, well, if we take a different example instead of a house and we think of just people talking philosophy, you know, well, what do you need to talk about philosophy? Well, physically, you need two people. Efficiently, well, what do you need? You need a reason for them to talk philosophy. So let's say they're both interested in it. The final cause, you could might say, would be creating an understanding of what knowledge is. Well, then what the formal problem is, well, then how do they do philosophy, or like, what is the form of philosophy? And I think this is actually I know we're philosophizing about what philosophy is, which is kind of a dangerous thing to do, but that seems to be the real problem for most people, is that they don't know the form of philosophy, and so therefore they don't want to do it, or they can't do it because they're unable to do it. So there's this, it's kind of like the same thing of like, if you don't know what kind of house to build, or you can't decide what kind of house to build because there's type different options, you'll never be able to build a house. Even if there's nothing materially obstructing you from doing so, there's some not physical, I was about to say spiritual principle, but I think that's the wrong word there to use as an adjective. So if someone wants to help me out with that, you have some non-material informational element, knowledge element, that you need in a system in order to get it to work. And I think that's what you're talking about when you're talking about the formal cause, which, if we abstract out philosophy from Plato and Aristotle, or even like to the group of all of the people we consider philosophers, all of them have what we call the form of philosophy. They have something that allows them to reason about things in a way that other people can understand them and copy their reasoning and apply it to problems the way that they did.
To be honest, I was going to go to Aristotle's four causes as well, and then Brandon brought them up and very eloquently described how that all worked. And the only thing I really wanted to point out then with that point is kind of back to some of our earlier discussions on, well, you know, the Enlightenment and like what we call the modern scientific period, walking away from Aristotle, obviously taking some significant nods from him, but sort of saying, you know, that, reason needs to go a different direction. With within like the context of Aristotle and the four causers, there's this obvious kind of background notion that there's an element of like, I guess I'll use the phrase like grand design going on, wherein like as Brandon so pointed out, like, you know, the cause of any being must be another being, and that obviously implicates some sort of chain, and like where that chain goes usually ends in some, with Aristotle, if I remember correctly, it's some sort of vague god being, although it's not elucidated super clearly, but obviously that whole structure is one that was very, what's what I'm looking for? Well, I'm just going to say there's a better phrase, but not liked by the modern scientist crew that came up with people like Hume and all that kind of thing, where its implications that there must be some sort of God involved in the nature of reality. So that was really the only thing that I was also going to add. But Brandon, again, did a fantastic job describing some of Aristotle's metaphysics there.
Thank you. And to add to that as well, one other thing specifically with the causes that gets kind of discarded in the movement forward is this notion of a final cause. As people go forward, if you're familiar with what's getting discarded, it's usually called just teleology. It's not simply a final cause. It is any sort of purposiveness in nature at all. Things don't really act for any reason. There is simply, mechanistic is the term that usually gets used. David Hume's image of the pool balls on the billiard table. You have a sort of, even in that image, you presuppose a pool player. So things have to get started in some way, but once the ball starts moving, things are simply moving for mechanistic purposes. Houses have reasons for existing because humans impose themselves on nature. They organize nature in such a way as to suit their own purposes, to see final causes in things like trees or birds or waves or the movement of the stars and whatnot. That is on the rejection of the Aristotelian teleology, that is a human projection into nature, something that, just one more thing in Aristotle that was superseded. So it's just worth noting too, Aristotle obviously did have lots to contribute, but a lot of this stuff it didn't make the cut.
Yeah, you know what? With you saying that, I actually want to add kind of one more component. And it has less to do specifically with Aristotle, but more Plato and Aristotle in general. And I think it's a criticism that's often made, although I think it can kind of, you can do a bit of reverse Uno and, sorry, it's a criticism that often made by, you know, the more modern thinker type folks and stuff like that. Although I think you could do a reverse Uno and make the same sort of criticism. And that is that when we see Plato and Aristotle at their like most fundamental level, what we see is thinkers trying to make sense of their world from within the confines of their own world, right? And so what I like, that sounds a little vague, so to describe it a little bit better, both Plato and Aristotle were obviously operating in an ancient world of thought, and they were pulling and drawing from people who, although had very radically different perspectives, were all very deeply related and had some very similar thrusts. So when we think about like the pre-Socratics, we have people like Xenophon, sometimes I get their names wrong, Xenophanes, sorry, you know, who thought, I might be getting this one wrong, but anyways, that there's some fundamental element, right? So Xenophanes, if I remember, Brandon, maybe you can correct me, but it was like the world is fire, right? There's this fundamental element of fire in the world. And then obviously with the Pythagoreans, it was effectively number, a kind of, you might even call it numerology. Then you go into Heraclitus, and this is a gross, like, simplification, but, you know, the world is some kind of flux.